Okay, take your seats, please. It's now a particular pleasure to welcome back to Sydney Marlon Shapiro, who, as most of you will know, was with us for about 18 months or so, I think. That was a far too short a period quite recently. Marlon's going to be speaking to us on relativism without relative truth. Welcome, Marlon.
Thanks. Is the microphone working? Yes. Thanks mainly to Hugh and Matthew for giving me the perfect opportunity to try to work out a hunch about a relation between the ideas of three of our speakers, John McFarlane, Bob Brandom, and Hugh himself. I only hope that I won't be obscuring their respective babies in my murky bathwater. So, we'll go. So, okay. In a series of papers and a monograph that's in the works, John McFarlane has defended a relativist account of the semantic content of various kinds of discourse. He's at pains to distinguish his brand of relativism from other proposals that likewise involve a truth predicate that's relativized to various non-standard parameters. In this talk, I aim to highlight what I see as distinctive and attractive about McFarlane's version of relativism by transposing it into a different key altogether, namely by recasting it independently of any semantic framework of relativized truth. Instead, I'm going to argue, we can understand his idea in terms of a characterization of the practice of asserting, drawn with a key modification from Bob Brandom. I'm going to argue that my proposal has the advantage of providing a clearer rationale for the central distinguishing feature of McFarlane's relativism, namely his account of when retractions of assertions are called for. So one offshot, perhaps the main one, of my proposal will be a reconfiguring of the space of theoretical options. McFarlane presents his own relativism, which posits a semantic feature he calls assessment sensitivity, or technically a post-semantic feature he calls assessment sensitivity. He presents this as a radical departure from the classical semantic tradition, which attributes to each proposition a condition for it being, absolutely speaking, true. By contrast, McFarlane views most alternative versions of relativism, other than his own, versions that posit only a feature he calls youth sensitivity, as opposed to assessment sensitivity, he views those as a much less radical departure from absolutism. So we get McFarlane's three grades of semantic relativism. If we start with absolutism, essentially the classical, essentially Frege-ian tradition of truth conditional semantics, and we then liberalize or generalize the framework somewhat, we get, in his view, use sensitivity, but we remain on, as he puts it, the safe side of the really interesting line. And then if we further relax the framework and make room for what he's proposing we need to make room for, assessment sensitivity, now we have a description of language use, account of language use that's interesting and controversial. But the relation between the two revisionist views is reversed, I'm going to argue, if we conceive of classical tradition in terms of Brandom's account of assertoric force, his account of the normative structure of what he calls the game of giving and asking for reasons. So I'm going to argue that a partial relaxing for certain discourses of Brandom's requirements on all fact-stating discourse is going to yield a pragmatic counterpart of what McFarlane calls assessment sensibility. And which I agree is an interesting and controversial and attractive, I think, view. By contrast, I'm going to argue that making room for a pragmatic counterpart of what McFarlane calls use sensitivity would require yet a further relaxing of Brandom's requirements. And I'm going to suggest that the result may be incoherent as a description of any fact-stating discourse at all. I should note, in light of Bob's talk at this conference, that I'm the quote there, fact-stating discourse, is from making it explicit. It's the very broad sense in which any assertion is fact-stating, not the narrower notion he carved out at this conference. Okay, so in summary, my proposal is to replace claims about the characteristics that are taken on by truth in different discourses by claims about the stringency with which different discourses can embody the full Brandomian game of giving and asking for reasons. The claim that there are such differences in stringency is, in effect, a prominent theme in Hugh Price's book, first book, Facts and the Function of Truth. John must have. In fact, I know John was in college when that was. Yes. I thus view my pragmatic reconstruction of assessment sensitivity as one way to flesh out Hugh's denial in that book that there is, as he puts it, a sharp distinction between fact stating and non-fact stating uses of language. Okay. On to the first of many preliminaries. Let me start by explaining one way to think of McFarlane's aim and approach. He aims to explain the apparently distinctive functioning of a wide-ranging class of expressions. The most frequently discussed of these have been epistemic modals, as we heard today, as well as so-called predicates of personal taste, such as tasty and funny. At issue is the way the use of such expressions appears to involve, one might say, subjective or perspectival aspect. Specifically, in some sense, the appropriateness of assertions using such expressions appears to depend on features of the speaker's perspective, even though the assertions don't appear to be about the speaker's perspective. That's the subject matter point that John brought up. This is testified to by the possibility of what Price, in the same book, calls evaporative disputes. Those are disputes in which one party, once apprised of relevant differences of perspective between the parties, ceases to take there to be anything amiss about what she continues to regard as the other party's assertion of what is not the case. Incidentally, it's intentional here that I'm avoiding the term no-fault disagreement. This is because some, including McFarlane, hold that there is a sense of disagree such that it's not sufficient, it doesn't suffice for there to be a state of disagreement that one party deny the claim that the other party asserts. And it's not obvious that Price's evaporative disputes even start out with a state of disagreement in this stronger sense. Okay, end parenthetical. So faced with this seemingly distinctive functioning of the target discourses, McFarlane rejects two explanations that we might classify as metaphysically eliminativist regarding the apparent subject matter of the discourses. One such metaphysically eliminativist option is a traditional expressivism. According to this view, we don't use the word tasty, say, to ascribe any property, and we don't use might or is possible to assert the obtaining of any modal states of affairs. A second metaphysically eliminativist option is a traditional contextualism. According to that view, we use the word tasty to attribute various perfectly objective properties, such as that of tasting good, to a particular speaker at a particular time. But there is no such thing as the property of being tasty simpliciter on the traditional contextualist view. By contrast, McFarlane's own pronouncements, in a, one might say, metaphysical key, need differ in no way from those of the objectivist. For example, he affirms that there is such a property as the property of being tasty simpliciter. So he tells us that the predicate tasty invariantly expresses a single property, the property of being tasty. He holds that this property is not possessed by fish sticks. Last I knew, he also held that it is not possessed by Becherovka herbal liquor, but that it is possessed by hominy and by Straub's beer, notwithstanding that brewery's evident inferiority complex. Uh, I don't, for the Australians here, I don't know whether John is enough of a Platonist to believe that the tasty itself has the property of being tasty. Similarly, in McFarlane's view, there is a property an animal has when it might not be a rodent. Relatedly, when he appeals to, and here I may differ from something he said earlier today, but when he appeals to possible worlds in his semantics, it is no part of the view, or at least it need be no part of his view, that these worlds could be described in a fully non-perspectival vocabulary. So it may be a feature of a possible world that hominy is tasty in that world, though this would have to be a world in which hominy had a very different objective properties than it does in the actual world. And it is a feature of many possible worlds, including, I'm told, the actual world, that the guinea pig might not be a rodent in those worlds. So much of what McFarlane says needs sound no different from what an objectivist will say. How then does his view differ from a full-blown objectivism about tastiness and epistemic possibilities? What might it mean to say that a property or state of affairs is subjective? To answer these questions, he focuses on how the vocabularies in question fit into the normative structure of the practice of language use, in particular assertion. His overarching strategy is to start, he says, with an account of assertoric force that is acceptable to the non-relativist, and then ask how we might extend that account to capture the distinctive functioning of the target discourses. What we need, he argues, is a suitably generalized theoretical description of the normative structure of assertoric practice. This would be a framework that accommodates both our target subjective discourses and objective discourse, the latter as a special case, and thus illuminates the differences between them. At least one of the accounts of assertoric force that McFarlane proposes is avowedly inspired by Brandom. But it differs from Brandom's own account in a number of ways, most obviously in making essential theoretical appeal to a notion of truth, as came out in the discussion session of the last talk. Specifically, the notion of a proposition being true relative to a pair of contexts. I'm going to argue that McFarlane's purposes can be better served by something closer to Brandom's own account of the normative structure of assertoric practice. So first, let me give a brief overview of that account, Brandom's account, before turning to McFarlane's own. So, next preliminary. According to Brandom, asserting is a speech act. This is something Brandom wrote when John was in junior high, I gather, by which one not only licenses further assertions on the part of others, but commits oneself to justifying the original claim. Asserting thus involves claiming a kind of authority and undertaking a corresponding kind of responsibility. The responsibility undertaken in asserting is asserting proposition is to vindicate one's entitlement to assert the proposition when appropriately challenged. Entitlement can be vindicated in various ways, among them by inference and by deferral to another speaker's authority, another person's authority. The authority claimed in asserting a proposition is to license others privy to the assertion to vindicate their entitlement to assert the proposition by deferral to the original asserter. For short, I'll say this is a matter of licensing others to assert the proposition. Whether an assertion succeeds in this licensing depends on two factors, whether the asserter indeed possesses the entitlement in question, and whether the audience member has some attitude or other status that precludes her from inheriting from that asserter an entitlement to assert the proposition in question. Unlike Brandom, I will have little to say about what might serve as such a defeaser. Suffice it to say, that someone's having issued an unretracted denial of a proposition will count as a defeasor for the transmission of entitlement from another person's assertion of the same proposition. Let me point to what, for my purposes, will be the most important consequence of this analysis. So it isn't itself a normative failing of an assertion of a proposition that it fails to entitle some member of its audience to assert that proposition. That's because the only failure involved might be on the part of that audience member whose attitude or status defeats the licensing claimed in the asserting. Nonetheless, denying that a proposition one takes someone to have asserted, denying a proposition one takes someone to have asserted always does amount to taking there to be something defective about that assertion. That's because when I myself deny the proposition P, according to Brandom, I void the communicative authority claimed in her asserting of P to entitle me as audience member to assert that P. And while I am denying P, I cannot, for essentially more paradoxical reasons, take the fault to lie with my own denial rather than with her assertion. So Brandom's analysis thus accounts for a feature of assertoric practice much stressed by Price, namely that its practitioners take truth to be what Price calls a third norm besides those of sincerity and justification. So here is Hugh's third norm statement. If B takes A to have asserted a false proposition, B thereby takes there to be something defective about A's assertion. Unlike Brandom, Price holds that this feature could be added to a previously intelligible practice of, let's say, proto-assertion and proto-denial via the adoption of a normatively laden use of the predicates true and false. I see little reason to think that Price is right, that the full-blown practice of assertion can be constitutively explained in terms of the addition of this feature to a previously intelligible practice. But I will propose that he is right, that there's room for something less than the full Brandomian game of giving and asking for reasons. There's room for a practice that's characterized by a qualified version of 3N. We can understand such a practice by seeing how the fully Brandomian normative structure of asserting is a special case of a more general structure. So still preview, my basic proposal here is going to be that we can recover the essential features of McFarlane's relativist analysis of various kinds of vocabulary by relaxing Brandom's requirements somewhat. So consider an assertion of the proposition that tasty cheese is tasty. On the relaxed view, the asserter is no longer claiming authority to license all who become aware that she has asserted this proposition to assert the proposition themselves. Rather, she is only licensing such assertion by those who occupy a certain perspective. In this case, those who share a similar standard of taste. Hence, only a challenge coming from someone who occupies that perspective is one that she is obliged to respond to. And only one who denies the proposition while occupying that perspective, need take there to be anything defective about her assertion. The proposal, then, is that the assertoric force of an assertion of certain kinds of propositions has a perspectival aspect. Very roughly, an assertion may carry its licensing potential, Brandomian licensing potential, not vis-a-vis its entire potential audience, but rather vis-a-vis a target audience restricted to those who share a particular perspective. In the case of a proposition about tastiness, the relevant target audience will be picked out by possession of a relevantly similar standard of taste. In the case of propositions about epistemic possibility, the target audience will be picked out by possession of a relevantly similar body of information. Notice that I haven't said that the perspective that defines the relevant target audience needs to be fixed by its relation to the perspective occupied by the asserter herself at the time of assertion. Indeed, it's going to be central to my proposal for reconstructing assessment sensitivity in Brandomian terms that this is never going to be the case. So to conclude this preliminary summary, I think it might be useful to contrast the perspectivalism I am going to be suggesting with two varieties recently distinguished by Jonathan Schaffer. Schaffer contrasts what he calls meaning perspectivalism, the view traditionally known as contextualism, with what he calls truth perspectivalism, which includes McFarlane's relativism and a bunch of other views. I'm going to be proposing that McFarlane's purposes, as I have described them, can be met more directly by a third, this time not semantic but pragmatic, brand of perspectivalism, an assertoric force perspectivalism. So that's the preview of where I'm headed. Next task is to explain McFarlane's own relativist account of the functioning of target discourses, our target discourses. McFarlane chooses to reserve the label relativism for a view according to which the truth of a proposition is assessment sensitive. Since the relativism I wish to sketch is intended to include a counterpart of McFarlane's assessment sensitivity, it's going to be important to get clear about what assessment sensitivity is. So McFarlane's exposition sometimes suggests, including today, that what is distinctive of his relativism is the central semantic notion with which it operates. He writes, relativism as developed here is the view that truth-conditional semantics should have as its output a definition of truth relative to a context of use and a context of assessment. On this understanding, a non-relativist theory that features only use sensitivity may operate with a dyadic predicate, true PC. I'm going to be capitalizing this true to make explicit that it isn't the ordinary monadic truth predicate that obeys various disquotational principles. This is the theoretical truth predicate introduced in McFarlane's semantics. Related non-relativist theory, where P is a proposition and C is a context. By contrast, on this way of understanding things, a relativist theory that features assessment sensitivity must operate with a triadic predicate, true P, C1, C2. For on this understanding, relativism requires that a proposition needs to be evaluated for whether or not it is true relative to the context CU at which it is used and the context CA at which it is being assessed. In particular, it's very important that assessment sensitivity is not a claim about the status of the distinct proposition I'm going to call TP, to the effect, the proposition to the effect that P is true in the ordinary non-theoretical monadic sense. For P to count as assessment sensitive, it's not enough that this truth assessment TP needs to be evaluated for whether or not it is true relative to the context CU star at which that assessment TP is used. In a slogan here, use sensitivity of assessments does not amount to assessment sensitivity. This is something that I think many people writing on McFarlane's relativism ignore. Assessment sensitivity, it would appear, requires a twofold relativization of propositional truth. But although this understanding is suggested by McFarlane's exposition, I think it's misleading. Now, it's true, and it's important, that use sensitivity of assessments doesn't amount to assessment sensitivity. But I'm going to argue now that assessment sensitivity, in McFarlane's sense, in his interesting sense, doesn't actually require additional relativization of the truth predicate. The difference between assessment sensitivity and mere use sensitivity isn't a matter of whether the truth predicate is triadic or non-trivially triadic. Of course, we could define the label assessment sensitivity this way, but then it would cease to mark an interesting distinction among theories of language use. Instead, the difference between assessment sensitivity and mere use sensitivity is a matter of how the truth predicate gets employed in an account of the practice of asserting propositions. To see this, I'm going to first state a version of one of McFarlane's proposed accounts of assertion using only a dyadic truth predicate. Then I'm going to explain why he himself sees the need for the more complex account involving the triadic predicate. And we're going to see that his reasons for appealing to the triadic predicate have nothing to do with assessment sensitivity per se. So McFarlane argues that assertion may be understood as a speech act constitutively governed by two rules, one governing permission to assert a proposition, and the other governing obligation to retract a previously asserted proposition. The first of these rules, he concedes, could be stated using a dyadic truth predicate. So here's my version of the rule, as an agent is permitted to assert P in context C U, context of U, CU, only if P is true relative to that context. For example, I am not permitted to assert in my present context that Canberra might be a coastal city. This is because in view of the body of information I possess at my current context, that modal proposition is not true with respect to this context. Yet someone who lacks the relevant information may not be forbidden by this norm from asserting that Canberra might be a coastal city. Essential to assessment sensitivity, though, is a second constitutive norm, which I'm going to again, and this is the key point, state using only a dyadic predicate. So, ret. An agent in context CA context, is required to retract an assertion of P she previously made at an earlier context if it is not the case that P is true with respect to this CA. For example, assuming I previously asserted that Canberra might be a coastal city, I am now required to retract that assertion. Notice that I may be required to retract an assertion even though I was permitted to make it in the first place. The account of assertion consisting of these two norms, as and ret, I claim, should qualify as involving genuine assessment sensitivity by McFarlane's lights, and thus as genuinely relativistic, despite only using a dyadic truth predicate. What genuine assessment sensitivity requires is simply that norms applying to an assertion in a given context can involve the truth of the asserted proposition relative to a second context at which that assertion is assessed. In other words, it's not important that the theory employs a semantic predicate true as used at CU and assessed from CA. Rather, what suffices for assessment sensitivity is that the account of the practice of assertion makes non-trivial use of a pragmatic predicate, must be retracted when used at CU and assessed from CA. Notice furthermore that the context of assessment that does the work in McFarlane's account of assertion always features the same agent as the context of use. Whether an assertion is true or false, whether a proposition is true or false as assessed by some other agent other than the one who asserted it, plays no role whatsoever. This seldom noted feature of McFarlane's relativism will be important later on. Now, I hasten to add that McFarlane himself formulates the retraction norm using a triadic truth predicate. So essentially like this, ret star. An agent in context C, we saw this today, CA is required to retract an assertion of P she made at an earlier context CU if it is not the case that P is true with respect to CU and CA. Why? The reason is that, according to McFarlane, our simplified norm ret, the one involving only the dyadic truth predicate, may require too many retractions. The problem is that if there are propositions of a certain sort, propositions that he would classify as involving contents that are use-sensitive but not assessment-sensitive, the norm I stated will require too many retractions. To see this, as a simple example, assume that temporalists are right, that there is a time-neutral proposition that it is raining in Sydney that can be true relative to some times and false relative to others. Suppose I asserted this proposition during a Sydney rainstorm. Then the norm I originally stated, ret, would require me to retract the assertion once the rain stops. But this requirement would be absurd. So assuming that there is such a time-neutral proposition, there's clearly no normative conflict between my standing by my past assertion of this proposition that it is raining in Sydney and my presently denying the same proposition. McFarlane wants to make room for propositions like the temporalists, propositions he describes as involving contents that are use-sensitive but not assessment-sensitive. More precisely, they're sensitive to features of the context of use that can change for a given speaker over time, unlike the world of use. If our account invokes no such features, the difference between use sensitivity and assessment sensitivity vanishes. This is why he needs to state his retraction norm using a triadic relation. To see this, consider another example. The conjunctive proposition, call it P, that it is raining in Sydney and tasty cheese is tasty. Suppose that I am today assessing whether I need to retract an assertion I made yesterday of that conjunction. The answer will depend on my standard of taste today. That's the assessment sensitivity of the content is tasty. But it's going to depend on yesterday's weather. That's the use sensitivity of the content is raining. So whether or not I am, assuming that we have time-neutral contents. So whether or not I'm obliged to retract my assertion will depend on whether P, this P, is true with respect to CU and CA. So in general, the circumstances in which my simplified norm, RET, has unacceptable consequences, and we need the more complicated one, can be specified without using any notion of truth. They are circumstances in which, I'm going to call this use sensitivity, US, there is a proposition P such that the same person in the same world may affirm and deny P at different times and retract neither speech act without incurring any normative deficiency. Part of my goal in what follows is to give a description of the normatively governed practice of assertion that essentially involves propositions for which this circumstance is ruled out. I should add, I would be happy to allow that there may be another sense of the word proposition for which this kind of circumstance can occur that might be useful for other purposes, so that there could be time-neutral propositions star, say. Such propositions might be required for purposes of compositional semantics in languages, if there are languages with tense operators. But they're not. This is not the sense of assertion that will figure in the a sense of proposition that's going to figure in the pragmatics of assertoric practice. Let us assume that McFarlane's retraction norm, which accounts for the sense in which his theory posits assessment sensitivity, can be simplified as I've been proposing, so that we don't need the triadic. It's enough to have the dyadic truth predicate in it. Without further explanation, though. We shouldn't be satisfied with the claim that being subject to this norm is essential to the speech act of assertion. What we'd like, I think, is an understanding of why there might be a practice of assertion that essentially involves this particular norm. What difference does this norm make to the kind of speech act that is governed by it? One attractive answer is suggested by Branham's account of assertion as a kind of endorsement that remains in effect until withdrawn by means of a retraction. This might appear to be a departure from McFarlane's approach in terms of norms, constitutive norms governing assertion. But he, in fact, argues that his relativism can be understood both ways. The relativist can understand assertion either in terms of norms for making assertion or, following Branham, in terms of assertion's normative effects. In fact, McFarlane suggests that the two kinds of account may be compatible. So in this section, I'm first going to explain how McFarlane's version of the view of asserting as a kind of endorsing for one's audience might appear to explain his retraction norm. Then I'm going to argue that the appearance is misleading. McFarlane's modification of Branham's view doesn't explain why assertoric practice should involve McFarlane's requirements regarding retraction. And then in the next section, I'm going to argue that my proposed modification to Branham's endorsement account does better in vindicating what I think is the essence of McFarlane's position concerning retraction and thus concerning relativism for the vocabularies in question. So, as an endorsing, Branham argues, asserting has two aspects. It's an authorizing and it's a taking of responsibility. There are two ways that McFarlane can be seen as appealing to this picture. depending on how we construe the endorsement part. The difference emerges when we consider the kind of responsibility involved. In effect, though he doesn't put it this way, McFarlane distinguishes two very different senses of making oneself responsible for a proposition's truth. First, one may undertake to accept responsibility for one's conduct in making the assertion in the event that the proposition is shown to be untrue. Accepting responsibility for having endorsed an untrue proposition might include doing such things as apologizing profusely, that's a quote from John, making amends, or refraining from complaint when one's assertions are ignored in the future. Let us summarize this as making oneself responsible as a guarantor. Second, one may make oneself responsible for the proposition's truth in the sense that one accepts justificatory responsibility, in the sense of undertaking to show that the proposition is true when appropriately challenged. Let's call this making oneself responsible as a vindicator. Understood either way, making oneself responsible for a proposition's truth is the flip side of authorizing one's audience to rely on the proposition's truth in their reasoning and action. In the first case, on the basis of one's guarantee, and in the second case, on one's epistemic authority. So can McFarlane use either of these explanations of the responsibility involved in asserting to explain why asserting becomes subject to something like his retraction norm once we relativize propositions to propositional truth to context? Suppose that by asserting P, the proposition P, at context CU, a speaker makes herself responsible as a guarantor or a vindicator for P's truth relative to subsequent contexts. Suppose also that for some subsequent context CA, it is not the case that P is true relative to CA. Then it would seem that the asserter's continuing commitment as a guarantor or vindicator becomes inappropriate, whether she realizes this or not, and whether it was initially appropriate or not. Hence, one could argue retraction will be in order, as required by the norm ret. Of course, one might resist the step from claiming that a retraction would, in given circumstances, remedy an inappropriateness to endorsing a rule requiring retraction in those circumstances. Still, already the claim about when retraction would remedy an inappropriateness promises to capture much of the force of McFarlane's assessment sensitivity. Though McFarlane does suggest that the need for retractions is connected to the endorsing role of assertions, he doesn't officially use the endorsement account of assertion to derive his retraction norm. Instead, he proposes that the, quote, the commitment one undertakes in making an assertion includes, he says, a commitment to retract one's assertion, P, at context CA, in the event that it's shown to be the case that P is not true relative to that context CA. Since retracting one's assertion is withdrawing the commitment undertaken in asserting, any explanation of that commitment as concerning retraction, I think, raises a prima facie circularity worry. For this reason, I think it's preferable to derive the appropriateness of retraction from a separate account of the commitment undertaken in an assertion, as opposed to having a commitment to retract as part of what one is undertaking. If the above is right, making sense of the speech act of asserting as a kind of endorsing for one's audience requires viewing the speech act as one that should be retracted when the proposition asserted is untrue relative to a subsequent context. We would seem to have a motivation for McFarlane-style assessment sensitivity. Unfortunately, there is a basic problem with this explanation of why retractions should be called for when the asserted proposition is untrue relative to a subsequent context of assessment. The problem is that, as I noted earlier, the contexts of assessment referred to in the retraction norm are always subsequent contexts occupied by the original asserter. Yet we were trying, or at least I was trying, to derive a norm governing retraction from Brandom's guiding thought that asserting is issuing an endorsement for one's potential audience to rely on. It should now be clear why this attempt won't succeed. we've been assuming that there are propositions that are true relative to some contexts and false relative to others. For example, the relevant features of context extend beyond possible worlds. For example, the proposition that tasty is tasty. Cheese. Surely there would be little point to a practice that involved endorsing propositions such as this one as true relative to the context of each potential audience member. McFarlane's perfectly clear about this. Accordingly, his specification of the justificatory responsibility undertaken in an assertion is essentially the one on your screen. In asserting P in context CU, an agent undertakes to provide for any context CA that this same agent occupies, in which the assertion is properly challenged, grounds for it being the case that P is true with respect to CA. My point, again, is that this formulation doesn't capture Brandom's guiding thought that an asserter is making an endorsement for others to rely on. If we're worried that McFarlane's account of when retractions are required looks unmotivated, it won't help to derive it from an account of asserting as endorsing for one's own future self alone. Here's where my proposed liberalization of the Brandomian account of assertion may help. On the revised view, recall, assertion of propositions in certain discourses may carry endorsing force vis-a-vis a restricted target audience. For example, someone who asserts that something is tasty is no longer claiming authority to license all who become aware of her assertion to assert this proposition. Rather, she's only licensing such assertion by those who occupy a certain perspective. That this perspective includes a standard of taste is determined by the inclusion of the concept tasty in the proposition asserted. But now it may seem hard to make sense of McFarlane's need to retract his childhood assertion that fish sticks are tasty in a later context of assessment relative to which this proposition is false. After all, on my proposal, young John is not endorsing the proposition for assertion by those in all contexts, such as his current context. The answer is that an asserter of P should be seen as claiming authority to license the assertion of P by any audience member who occupies a context that's relevantly similar, in a sense fixed by that proposition, to the context occupied by the asserter herself, not just at the time of assertion, but at any subsequent time. For example, the proposition that fish sticks are tasty might be such that someone asserting it claims entitling authority vis-a-vis all audience members whose standard of taste is relevantly similar to the standard of the asserter herself at any subsequent time. In that case, as long as John has not retracted his childhood assertion that fish sticks are tasty, he is still endorsing this claim for assertion on his authority by anyone who, in the relevant respects, shares his current standard of taste, including himself, of course. What are the consequences for retraction? The current proposal doesn't employ the notion of a proposition's truth relative to a context. That's why relativism without relative truth. Hence, the conditions in which retraction is called for can no longer be specified as ones in which the proposition asserted is not true at a subsequent context. Still, we can formulate two analogs of our original norm, ret. The first analog is a norm based on the conception of endorsement as undertaking of justificatory responsibility. So that's the Brandomian thought here. Consider John's childhood assertion that fish sticks are tasty. John might be able to vindicate his earlier entitlement to assert that proposition. But assuming that he can't currently vindicate his entitlement against the challenge, he should retract his childhood assertion. That's because, on the current view, the endorsement claimed through his childhood assertion extends to the present, vis-a-vis any audience whose standard of taste is relevantly similar to John's current standard. So we get an analog of ret stated without using a truth predicate, but instead using the notion of the ability to vindicate entitlement to a proposition. It's a pragmatic version of the retraction norm. If an agent can't currently vindicate entitlement to assert a proposition she previously asserted, she should retract that assertion. In addition to this statement of conditions in which a speaker should retract an assertion, we can also get a statement of conditions in which an audience member will take it that an assertion is defective as an endorsement and should be retracted. It's a qualified version of Price's principle 3N, the third norm, characterizing the normative structure of assertion. If B takes A to have asserted a false claim and takes herself to belong to the audience vis-a-vis which A's assertion claims entitlement transmitting authority, then B takes there to be something defective about A's assertion. Sticking with our example, we're no longer able to say that John is required to retract his childhood assertion in view of the propositions lacking the relational property of being true relative to his current context. Still, we can now say that if John currently denies that fish sticks are tasty, if he takes the proposition to be false in the ordinary monadic sense, he thereby takes there to be something defective about his childhood assertion, a defect that would be remedied by retracting that assertion. In short, we get this analog of McFarlane's retraction norm, Retstar Prague. If an agent takes herself to have inserted a false claim, she thereby takes there to be something defective about that assertion. Let me make it clear that I'm not saying that the idea of assertoric force perspectivalism that I've been promoting here couldn't be incorporated into an account of language use that appeals to the notion of a proposition's truth relative to a context, where the relevant features of context extend beyond possible worlds to features such as standards of taste and bodies of information. Rather, I'm suggesting that appeal to relative truth isn't necessary in order to capture what it is about the fundamental structure of the practice of asserting that explains why retraction should play the role that McFarlane describes. So I'm going to conclude by explaining why my proposal corresponds, in McFarlane's sense, to assessment sensitivity rather than to use sensitivity. Recall that on Brandom's own account of assertion, as endorsing, asserting a proposition counts as endorsing it for use by any potential audience member. I've proposed liberalizing Brandom's account by allowing for the endorsement of certain propositions to be directed at restricted target audiences. But the key is that I have also proposed a limit on the restrictions. On the view I'm recommending, an assertion claims authority to transmit entitlement vis-a-vis any audience member whose context is relevantly similar to any subsequent context occupied by the asserter. Assertion thus always involves sticking one's neck out with respect to one's own future contexts. By contrast, the analog within my framework of McFarlane's use sensitivity, or more precisely, use sensitivity to features of context that can differ for the same speaker at different times, so once again, not just to possible world, my analog of McFarlane's use sensitivity would involve no such sticking out of one's neck. On that view, asserting a proposition may count as endorsing it for use by a restricted audience, target audience that needn't include the original asserter at any future time. For example, someone's assertion that one might be able to purchase pinto beans in Sydney would claim entitlement transmitting authority only vis-a-vis those whose state of information is relevantly similar to the asserter's own at the context of assertion. In that case, there would be no normative conflict between someone's assertion in one context that one might be able to purchase pinto beans in Sydney and her denial of the very same proposition at a subsequent context in which the first assertion is not retracted. She could later say, "Yes, what I asserted then is untrue, but why is there any problem with that?" A practice that allowed for use sensitivity in this sense would resemble a fictional practice described by Price. He contemplates a community of what he calls merely opinionated asserters who never take each other to be attributing any normative failing when one of them denies the claim the other has asserted. Price suggests that this is not a coherent description of a practice in which propositions get asserted. I suspect that the same is true of a description of a practice as containing use sensitivity, a practice where an asserter doesn't endorse a proposition for use, at least, by herself in future contexts. Such a description wouldn't count as a description of what is, even in a minimal sense, a game of giving and asking for reasons. Of course, if this is right, it remains to be explained what the point is of having assertions of propositions about tastiness and epistemic possibility at all, rather than non-propositional expressions of preferences or credences. Here I'm sympathetic to the idea, voiced by both Price and McFarlane, that the resulting opportunity for controversy encourages the coordination of perspectives, though, as we heard, the expressivist may also be able to take advantage of that. In this talk, I merely hope to have made plausible the thought that the kinds of discourses that McFarlane describes as involving assessment-sensitive truth might more revealingly be described as instantiating a liberalized yet still recognizable version of Brownian's game of giving and asking for reasons.
Thank you, Lionel.
Sure.
David,
first. Yeah, so just to get a better idea of how this all is supposed to work, I just want to know what you want to say about the following kind of puzzle that Isaac Levi and some other people like to make a lot of weight out of. Yesterday, the weather wasn't so great, and so I was willing to say both, well, maybe it will rain on Friday, and maybe it won't rain on Friday.
Yeah.
Now, Friday comes along, and it seems really sunny out, so I no longer say, maybe it'll rain on Friday. In fact, I deny it, because I'm really optimistic.
Yeah.
Do I count as having retracted what I said before? And if so, it seems a little bit funny, because it looks like it's still vindicating what I said before. It made sense when I said it, based on my evidence.
Yeah, you can't vindicate it relative to your current context. You can vindicate your entitlement relative to your previous context.
It's
the worry that you can predict.
It's
a thought that you can that this is a case where in saying what was the example, it might rain and it might not. You in saying that you can predict basically that you're going to have to retract when challenged at a later context. Is that the thought?
Well, I mean, you said, well, when you assert something, you kind of commit yourself to defending it later on, but...
So it wouldn't make sense to do that, is what your thought is.
But with these doxastic modals, you end up always giving one of them up once you learn certain future information. So, I mean, the way Isaac Levi likes to present the puzzle is about belief forbidden. Modals aren't preserved the way ordinary factual claims are, which he then takes to further show that they don't express propositions. Put aside his argument about those. I was just trying to get a better sense of what retraction and vindication amount to. You know, I'm one of these horrible subjectivist, contextualist people in much more like this context.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, for us, we'd say, well, you know, yesterday you expressed a proposition relative to your evidence then.
Yeah.
Now you express a different one. You can't use the same words you use now then because it'll give you the wrong thing. But you still agree that, you know, I don't retract the proposition I said yesterday. That's still
On this view, you do. I don't differ, I think, from John on that. This is something that I've at times been uncomfortable about, the kind of case where in making an assertion, if you're self-conscious enough, reflective enough, realize that no matter what happens when challenged the next day, you will have to retract. I'm not sure that really is a problem. I mean, it would be a problem if the undertaking of responsibility were the result of deliberation, let's say. But it's an implicit undertaking of responsibility. It's not as if I, on various grounds decide to issue a certain guarantee. It's just a feature of, this is what an assertion is, and it happens to be the case that in these circumstances, that kind of a practice will involve cases where you're guaranteed to the next day have to retract when appropriately challenged. I'm not. It's a little weird, but I'm not sure that it's a problem. Am I at all getting?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So we just disagree on whether it's a problem.
Yeah, but But the answer is yeah. The view is committed to that.
Patrick,
I'm worried about how your proposal generalizes to all the things that someone like McFarlane
wants to do. I mean, you focused on predicates of personal taste, but one of the seeming virtues of Kant's approach is that we can talk about knowledge being shifted.
Yeah.
Now, I'm worried about the way you set up the norms being too restrictive to, as it were, go through the standard procedures that people say, hey, look, there's some shifty data. Let's take that seriously. Oh, we've got some norms. That just shows that some predicates of a certain type, like knows, are themselves shifty. So it's crucial. If you go back, can you go back, pull back your attraction norm?
The original, my version of his, or my,
or you favor?
Mine. Let's see. So these various things here, yeah. These are the things that I was.
I mean, the worry is that to extract the kind of view that you eventually want, these norms, I mean, the retraction norm seems to be stated as it's a sufficient condition to retract that the proposition that one asserted is now untrue.
Oh, wait, this is my version of his, because I'm not using true.
Right, well, exactly. Well, the sort of the Brandoing analog is that, well, look, if you can't vindicate it now, then you should retract. Now, I'm interested in whether or not that's a biconditional or not, because I suspect that you need to state these norms in biconditional format, but the danger of once you do that is, it looks like, hey, look, it's assertable that my car is parked outside, or I know that my car is parked outside. It no longer becomes assertable, indeed, I want to retract on that previous assertion. If you get a biconditional, then the stuff that you get on the right-hand side, namely, I can vindicate the utterance, is true, but it looks like there's some shiftiness in the locution. I can vindicate the utterance. So my worry is once you set these things up in biconditional format, you get a shifty view, no longer with knowledge, but with Brandon's expression, I can vindicate the entitlement to P. But then the question is, well, it's shifty in what sense? Shifty in truth value? And then we seem to be back into some kind of relativism with respect to truth.
I'm afraid I haven't quite gotten it. So turning this into a biconditional would seem wrong on many grounds, right? There could be reasons why one should retract an assertion, even if one could vindicate entitlement to assert it. I don't know, it might hurt someone's feelings or something.
Well, we're thinking about epistemic notions of retraction, not breaking
epistemic
norms.
Epistemic should, so it's a question about the... Yeah. Yeah. So what if... So the worry is that somehow specific to the knowledge case, there would be a particular problem with saying that if I should retract an assertion I've already made, then I can't currently vindicate it. In other words, only if I can't currently vindicate it should I retract it. Why? I'm missing it.
The standard way of deriving shiftiness from the data is to say P is assertable, or the sentence is assertable, it becomes unassertable. Yeah. Unassertable entails lack of truth or lack of knowledge, only with a certain direction of the norm, a direction that seems to be missing from your account. Okay. So if I can vindicate P, that means that P is assertable. Yeah. Uh-huh. But the thought is if it becomes unassertable, it means I can't vindicate. Now, once you get into these sort of areas, you're getting into deep water, because it looks like the phrase is able to vindicate P becomes shifty, semantically shifty. And once it's semantically shifty, you need relative truth to make sense of that. That's the word.
I'm afraid I'm not getting it.
We can talk about it later.
I mean, obviously, I haven't said much about what vindicating entitlement in any particular to any particular kind of proposition, such as a knowledge ascribing proposition, would amount to. But that's not what you're talking about. Somehow,
it's a general worry about the strategy of trying to avoid relativism about truth or any kind of genuinely semantically shifty view by saying, what I'm going to do is I'm going to mess about with the bridging principles that take you from assertability to truth or knowledge. What I'm saying is there's a real risk there, because once you start building in the biconditional
seems you would have to in the end. You've got to get a shifty view out again, a semantically shifty view. Maybe not with respect to Noah's, but with respect to Brandom's claim, one is in a position to vindicate the entitlement to be. That holds in the low standards context. Mm-hmm. One is no longer in a position to assert that in the other context. What best explains that? A shift in truth value, not of the term Noah's now, but with this surrogate for Noah's, one is in a position to vindicate the entitlement.
I mean, would there be a problem?
The truth comes back in the picture.
Would there be a problem, though, of applying the very account to itself? I mean, that's the kind of thing that often arises in philosophy. So, I mean, in effect, I take you to be saying that what I'm calling the target discourses include not just, for instance, predicates of personal taste and epistemic modals, but also the very language used in stating these normative principles, such as talk of what one should retract or ought to retract, etc. Is that if so? I'm not entirely sure why one couldn't apply the same proposal to.
I think that's the right way to go, but I think there's still a problem there. Even if you go that way, you have to be very careful how you state the bridging principles between the pragmatics and the shiftiness.
We'll have to talk about that.
John, did you have a hand?
I have a hand. Yeah.
Yes.
Two in fact.
We probably got time for both.
What's the context here?
It's really interesting. I wanted to see if I kind of understand what I think is sort of the main argument, kind of about three-fourths of the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, I agree with you that it was sort of a mistake on my part to build in, sort of a commitment to retracting. That's the wrong way to go about it. And so I agree with you that you'd want to be able to derive any norm for retracting from whatever kind of positive, guaranteeing, vindicating thing, a commitment you're undertaking and making the assertion. Okay.
Yeah.
So that seems right. Now, where I'm a little less clear is why you think that without kind of bringing in other people, the audience, I can't do that. So suppose I say, okay, I'm committing myself to vindicating the thing, and it's spelled out as saying, at any future context I occupy, committed to showing it's true is assessed from that context.
Yeah.
That's what vindicating is.
Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah.
And that's what it said. So then they say, well, what about retracting? Say, well, suppose I'm in some future context where it's not true relative to that context. Well, that'd be a context where I couldn't fulfill the commitment to vindicate, and
so
surely I ought to retract.
Yeah.
Why isn't that enough? Why do I need to start talking about other people?
In a sense, it's enough, right? It gets you what you want. It just seems to me lacking in sort of motivation and rationale. Why should there be a practice that involved that kind of commitment? I find Bob's basic thought of assertion as making available claims for use uptake by others, in fact, it's entitling them, it's a communicative view of assertoric practice that on the surface, I think, is more attractive than one that stipulates that, well, look, there's this rule about how you're committed to vindicate your entitlement in your own future context when challenged. It seems to me that if one can get that out of a view like Bob's with a tweak, it might, and this is not obviously not a knockdown argument, it might provide a sort of deeper underlying rationale for the whole picture. In other words, take Bob's structure and just liberalize it in a certain way, and yours, in a sense, falls out. That's the thought.
No, I like that idea, but just to get clear, you're not really objecting to the deriving of a retraction norm from the vindication norm that I would give. It's just you don't think the vindication norm that I would give is one that is well-motivated.
Right. So the attempt was, the question, so the structure was, okay, it'd be nice if we could somehow make sense of why there's this retraction norm. One attractive move would be to get it from the vindication, the commitment undertaken in an assertion. I put on the table a way that you could take that route, which is what you've just summarized, and I'm proposing an alternative that I think might be more attractive. What I do, though it didn't come up, but I might as well say, find a little fishy is, remember I said that you can't derive the retraction norm from the permission norm. Attempt at one point to do that by saying, it's based on a thought that I in my current context might not be permitted to assert something in my past context. And in other words, I have to retract it if I'm not currently permitted to, in the past, make it. I'm not sure I understand that.
Yeah,
so that I would resist.
Yeah, I find that part pretty fishy, and I may end up getting rid of it. Yeah.
Matthew.
Hi, Lionel, thanks for the talk. It was very interesting. I just kind of have a request for further elaboration or maybe speculation, but I was wondering how you see this stuff that you were talking about today as interacting with the kind of picture that John drew earlier of the relationship between semantics and pragmatics.
Yeah. Good. So I'm suggesting that pretty much everything that's sort of relativistic about his view could be done at the level of the pragmatics. The semantics is somehow going to have to be involved in explaining how these propositions get expressed by sentences in language use. So it's going to have a compositional account that makes sense of how speakers how the linguistic practice manages to associate these propositions with the sentences. That I haven't said anything about. I did everything in terms of propositions here. It seems to me that a lot of what John does in the chapter of the book and in parts of the papers about assessment sensitivity versus use sensitivity is pretty independent of, and in essence that came out earlier in his talk, of the compositional semantics. Whether you're a relativist in his sense, whether you're a non-indexical contextualist in his sense, whether you're an objectivist, I was trying to sort of suggest, whether you're an expressivist, he suggested today, might make very little difference to the kind of compositional semantics you give. Now the question is, of course, then, do I have to concede that there will be a theoretically heavy, in some sense, use of truth, a notion of truth in that part of it, the semantic part that's independent of the relativism? I don't know. I'm attracted to the thought that ultimately the truth predicate one can use in that project it can be explained in terms of an ordinary disquotational truth predicate, but I don't really have commitments on that. But that I haven't seen why that's not the case, despite John's citing of Dummett. So does that at all help? Let me just make one point clear. To the extent that I'm proposing relativism without relative truth, that's not because I think. The argument doesn't go, there's something wrong with appealing to theoretically weighty notions of truth in accounts of language use. That wasn't the route that I was taking.
I've got myself on the list now. Lionel, you had on one of your slides my term evaporative.
Yes.
For what I also tended to call sort of no-fault disagreement.
Yeah, I was resisting that. Yeah,
I know. But one of the nice things about the term evaporative is that it kind of makes clear that there's a time direction involved.
Yes.
So there seems to be a dispute initially and it disappears. And in various contexts, I thought it was important that, I thought that direction was important.
and I tried to use as an argument against people who wanted to put the kind of the subjective stuff, the context or whatever, kind of into the content or into a truth condition. Because I thought that they couldn't account for that, because for them, where the cases of seeming disagreement would get, kind of get resolved too quickly, just as happens for a lot of indexical constructions, where you take the sort of superficial disagreement as an indication that the indexes must be different for the two speakers. And so I thought it was kind of important for that reason, and also because of the story about the role of the normative notion of truth in kind of aligning commitments. It was important that it have that sort of the notion of dispute have that default on character rather than a default off character. And I was just wondering whether the stuff you're doing here has anything to say about that sort of directionality.
I suspect that if speakers were aware of these relevant differences in their perspectives, they wouldn't see much point much of the time in initially engaging in a, as you call it, dispute, where one says P and the other says not P, to get that going in the first place. In most instances, probably it's going to require that they're not aware that this is a situation in which once they become more aware of their relevant perspectives, the dispute is going to evaporate.
I'm not sure that I have much of a question here.
When you use the word I use the word dispute. You said evaporative disagreement. I sort of did a sleight of hand. It seems to me at that point what you mean by disagreement is essentially dispute, such that these people could. I mean, they are disputing with each other whether or not someone like John would want to diagnose them as being in a state of disagreement. Later, they come to realize that in this one of the many weightier senses, they are not in fact in any state of disagreement. There's no normative conflict. They may have taken there to have been.
I agree with that characterization of what's going on. I didn't want it to be the case where that was obvious to them too soon. I thought if other ways of kind of characterizing the role of the what differs between them.
It could be that if in the end what this is an attempt to take basically Bob's framework and say that in certain particular kinds of language use, and it remains to be seen how far the iceberg goes, right? In your book, you suggest that it goes quite deep. But that if we start just with certain these special kinds of cases, there are these restricted target audiences, as I'm putting it. The default is going to be, presumably, to conduct one's asking and giving for reasons with a default presupposition that it's not like that.
Something like that.
And that would, I think, maybe account for the phenomenon you're mentioning.
Yeah, great. John again.
So you say something like, when you assert P, you're claiming authority to license assertion of P by any audience member occupying a context relevantly similar as used by P to any context occupied by the asserter at a subsequent time. And so that suggests that you're going to need some, if you do the theory this way, you're going to need some part of the theory that basically, for any P, outputs a relevant similarity notion.
Yeah.
And that's, that's going to have to be some kind of like compositional account of relevant similarity or something. It seems like a kind of somewhat ugly feature of
I've worried about that, it seems to me that the compositionality could be pretty simple. Forgetting about the use of the weasel word relatively here, although I'm not sure how apologetic I should be for that. The main point you're making I mean, what I was thinking of it, I guess, is, and maybe there's a prima facie obvious problem with this, but we'll see. These contents, these propositions, are composed of substantial contents, right, on your view, and the restrictions on the relevant perspectives, relevant context, contextual features, relevantly similar contextual features, are going to be determined by each of the substantial contents, and such that each one, so you get the intersection, in effect, of the if I have tasty in there and I have you know, beautiful or whatever, and you want to be relativist about both of those, that's going to further limit the target audience of speakers whom I'm claiming to entitle to the proposition.
Can I just ask about a particular example? Though?
Yeah.
Just take the example of epistemic modals. I mean, do you want to say that the relevant a relevantly similar context is one where the person has exactly the same information?
That's why I said relevantly. Yeah.
I mean, because it seems like with a possibility claim.
Yeah.
Right. Then you know, maybe a context which has less information would be okay. With an epistemic necessity claim, a context which has more information might be okay. But of course, one of those is just the negation of the other. And so you can't just say, oh, the sentence has a possible in it, so do this. It depends on how it's composed with negations. So in other words,
yeah.
I mean, that's the worry. And then you end up having to kind of recreate all this.
I see.
So the thought is, like, I mean, you could just say, look, it has to be exactly the same information, but if that's it, then it's kind of very limited in its relevance, because no one has exactly the same information as anyone else, really. You see kind of the...
I hadn't thought of the necessity possibility thing being an issue when one allows allows it to not be exactly. I'll have to think about that. I mean, there's other issues, such as, I don't know, if I say, if tasty cheese is tasty, then it is unpasteurized. And then I say tasty cheese is tasty. And you have a different gustatory standard, and you're in the audience. Somehow I still should be on this view of licensing you, despite your qualms about modus ponens, to the content that it's unpasteurized. I'm not sure that. So, I mean, that's a different worry. That one might be able to get around by. I wonder if there's something similar to be said about yours. I'll have to think about it. About by allowing not just assertions on one's own behalf, but also assertions on behalf of other perspectives, where you could be, by my asserting that conditional, and by the antecedent, you could be licensed to assert on my, from my perspective, tasty cheese is tasty, and conclude from my perspective that it's unpasteurized, realize that there's no different relevant difference there between our perspectives, and thereby entitled to conclude on your behalf that is unpasteurized. I'll have to think of whether, yeah. I don't really see how that idea would. Yeah, I'll have to think about your.
Well, just on that point, that seems going the long way around. I mean, I want to just take it, I want to detach on his part and say he's. Whoever uttered the conditional and the antecedent is committed to the conclusion, and now that's just an ordinary assertion.
Right. Sure. But if I haven't actually asserted it, so the thought is
committed to it.
Yeah. Have I thereby somehow entitled him? Am I on working out sort of your view? Is it the case that if I assert if P then Q and I assert P? Thereby, the scorekeeper should
attribute to you if you don't have defeating commitments, and I'm entitled to these, entitlement to Q. Is that?
Yes, then I take it that you have.
Yeah. Right, so that in fact is your view.
There's a dedicto de re.
Yeah.
Two sets of books.
Good. What that brings out is the part that I said I wasn't going to take on board, which is much of the scorekeeping account. Notice I only had a particular content, and the interpersonal transmission of entitlement. I have my worries about whether there are, in fact, content-based committive inferences, content-based permissive inferences, content-based incompatibilities, where it's just a matter of the content that is, rather than, say, how one came to what one's warrant is, say, how strong one's warrant is. And so I'm not sure that I'm prepared to follow you in claiming that somebody who is committed to certain contents is thereby, even independently of the fact that you have to explain what you mean by that, which I'd say you do, is thereby committed to another content. I'm not sure that, to the extent that I understand commitments to contents, there are such content-based relations of consequence. So, but that's a bigger issue. And I think your point, that in a sense, your proposal of going taking a simpler route to what I was saying, depended on ultimately my accepting that. And while I might be willing to do it for modus ponens, I don't know where I draw the line.
Does anyone have any further questions?
Yes. I just had a very small question about the relationship between retraction and denial.
Yeah.
So a simple example would be, suppose I'm willing to assert P or not P for some sentence P, some variable, and then I think about it, and the next day, well, I don't want to assert that anymore. So what am I retracting? Because I'm certainly not going to deny P or not P.
Right. So, there's a difference between retraction and denial. Yeah.
So for example, I might deny that I was right to assert P or not P.
You could retract, but assert that you were right to assert it. Right? Retraction isn't, on this view, a concession of any fault in the original assertion.
So just what would I say? I'm just sort of curious about the detail, like when I'm making my retraction.
I take that back, or I don't. No longer stand by that. It might be different. John sometimes uses the expression "scratch that." That might be a way to do it. Which gets at the fact that I'm not conceding any fault in the original assertion. I think, and a lot of the discussion here in the literature. That aspect of his view hasn't been clear, so I think that in particular, for instance, Jonathan Schaffer assumes that retraction is going to be a concession of fault, and it's not on John's view.
There's lots of useful terminology for this in political discourse. Yeah. Which is, simply say, that's no longer one of my core commitments. Okay, any other? We've got time for one more quick question if anyone has one. Otherwise, let's thank Lionel.